Hi, I'm Matt Payne, and welcome to 20th Century Revolutions. Episode 2.29, Libya, 1911, Inver's War. Quick shout out to Brian Ma. Thank you so much for your ongoing support of the show. I really appreciate all of you who do support on Patreon and PayPal. It really, really does mean a lot. Thank you again. So before we start today, I want to make a couple of quick announcements. First off, we are nearing the end of Season 2. So after today's episode, there will be maybe 3 or 4 more episodes, depending on how things shake out, with the finale of this season ending in 1913 with the raid on the Sublime Porte, the end of the Balkan Wars, and the emergence of the CUP dictatorship under the three pashas, Talat, Enver, and Jemal, listed in order from most powerful and influential to least powerful and influential. Sorry, Jemal. Now, a lot is going to happen between now and then, but we are nearing the end of this season, so that's fun. Next, I am very excited to let you guys know that I have been working on a new podcast. Now, before you get too alarmed here, this does not mean that 20th Century Revolutions is over, though it will go on a temporary hiatus. As I'm sure many of you are aware, Mike Duncan has made his glorious return to historical podcasting. And seeing as I am such a big fan of Mike's that I made an entire sequel to his podcast, you can probably guess that I am pretty excited about this return. But it does put 20th Century Revolutions in an interesting place. Because even though it might be fun to go head-to-head David and Goliath style and see who can make the best season on the Irish Revolution, I've decided not to do that. Now, of course, there are many, many revolutions with stories that will need to be told, including the insane sequence of events in the post-Ottoman world during and following World War I that would give rise to the Turkish Republic and the modern Middle East and Balkans. So, I do plan to do a third season on the Ottoman collapse, and 20th Century Revolutions will always be here to tell all of those revolutionary stories that will still need to be told. But what is this new mysterious podcast, you might ask? Well, it's an idea that I've actually been playing around with for quite some time now, but it has taken me a while to fully get a handle on the best way to format it. But the podcast is called ISM, I-S-M, as in socialism, anarchism, fascism, capitalism, you get the idea. The format of ISM will be a bit different from 20th Century Revolutions. Now, it is still primarily a history podcast, but with a new focus, the history of ideologies and the social movements they inspire. In ISM, each season will trace one of the big political ideologies of our time. Socialism, fascism, capitalism, anarchism, liberalism, feminism, nationalism, Islamism, just to name a few. Each season will center on major historical events, where these ideologies were tested and reshaped, where they clashed or were somehow reborn. Ultimately, ISM is most interested in what happens when ideas meet the realities of power. So, how do historical forces shape political ideologies? And how do ideologies, in turn, shape the course of history and the actions of individuals? It's the back and forth ping-ponging between ideas and material conditions that we will be exploring. Because ideologies have meant many different things to many different people at many different times, each mini-series within a given season will center around one place in one year. Think Petrograd 1917, Barcelona 1936, Rome 1922. And in our first season, we will be covering the history of socialism. Some of the events early on in this season will likely feel pretty familiar to many of you, but we will be approaching them from a slightly new angle. Not just what happened, but what people thought they were doing, what ideological futures they were imagining, and what went down when it all met the realities of power. So we will begin in revolutionary Paris for the birth of socialism and anarchism, culminating in the Paris Commune of 1871 and its legacy on the radical left. Then we'll jump continents across to Chicago 1886 for the Haymarket Affair, when American labor, socialism, and anarchism exploded into mainstream American politics. From there, Petrograd 1917 and the contested rise of Bolshevism and Leninism. Then Berlin 1919 for the doomed Spartacist uprising and the civil war within socialism itself. And then finally, Barcelona 1936, for that brutal clash of ideologies called the Spanish Civil War, when anarchism, socialism, communism, and fascism all faced off in the streets. So that's the first arc, socialism's origins and the early revolutions. The next arc will trace the global spread of socialism during the Cold War. So we'll look at the split between Soviet communism and Third World Socialism, and how movements navigated the space between U.S. empire and Soviet orthodoxy. First, we'll travel to Belgrade, 1948, for the Tito-Stalin split and the rise of the non-aligned movement. Cairo, 1956, after that, for Nasser and Arab socialism. Beijing, 1958, for Mao and the Great Leap Forward. Havana, 1961, for the Bay of Pigs invasion and Cuba's declaration of a socialist identity. And finally, Algiers, 1962, for the end of the Algerian War of Independence and the global high point of anti-colonial Marxism. After that come the years of crisis and reinvention. So this third arc begins in that fateful year of 1968, and I'm thinking it will be interesting to do a paired episode here covering the explosion of domestic unrest in both the U.S. and the Soviet Union. So we'll start with the Prague Spring and Socialism with a Human Face, and we'll pair this with Oakland 1968, when the Black Panthers redefined socialism through anti-policing, black power, and global anti-imperialism. From there, we move to Santiago 1973 and the violent CIA-backed overthrow of democratic socialism and Salvador Allende. Saigon 1975 for the final victory of Vietnamese communism over U.S. imperialism. London 1984 and the Thatcher-era confrontation with organized labor. Berlin 1989 to watch the wall fall and to see Soviet communism suddenly collapse. Caracas 2002 and the pink tide in Latin America led by Hugo Chavez. And finally, New York 2011, as the Great Recession gives birth to Occupy Wall Street and a new generation begins to rediscover the language of class and inequality. After the season covering socialism, we will likely move on to fascism and then maybe anarchism, but who knows? But that is my exciting announcement. I'm still working on the first run of episodes because, phew, it's maybe a little ambitious, but we'll just have to see what happens. I am hoping to launch ISM later this year, and I will, of course, be keeping you all up to speed on the exact dates. But with all that said, let's get on with Libya 1911 for Inverse War. Last time, we covered the months and years directly following the solidification of power under the government of General Mahmoud Shevket and the CUP. This government was defined by increasing authoritarianism, as young and educated Mektebli officers loyal to the CUP were sent out to the provinces to bring unruly elements under more centralized control and to clamp down on nationalism deemed harmful to Ottoman unity. The immediate effect of this centralization was the exact opposite of what the Unionists had hoped to accomplish, as there was a marked increase in ethnic nationalism, with further calls for local autonomy and the outbreak of outright revolt against the CUP's militarized rule. This unrest was most immediate and most dramatic in the Albanian lands of the Ottoman Balkans. Under the pretense of rooting out chieftains who had remained loyal to Sultan Abdulhamid during the counter-revolution, Mahmoud Shevket and the overzealous CUP governor in Kosovo imposed harsh, draconian policies in the region, and these policies inflamed Albanians to such an extent that a large group of chieftains took a besa, or a solemn blood oath, to oppose the CUP. Meaning that, less than 2 years after taking a besa to support the CUP, these same chieftains were now openly opposing the CUP. In response to these uprisings, General Mahmud Shevket personally led an operation into Kosovo to crush the Albanians. And after defeating the rebels, Shevket then ordered summary executions, burned down whole villages, and closed down schools and publications viewed by the new government as overly nationalistic. In hindsight, the 1910 Albanian revolts were a major turning point. The revolts laid bare the deep contradictions and conflicts inherent in Ottomanism, as Albanians hoped to win further rights and privileges as a result of the revolution, while the CUP wanted to curtail these rights and privileges in the name of national unity. For the CUP, Albanian autonomy would dangerously weaken the periphery of the empire and expose them to the threats of European imperialism and Balkan nationalism. For Albanians, the CUP's harsh centralization and militarization was viewed as a betrayal of the promises of the revolution and as the replacement of Ottomanism with Turkification. And then finally, the Albanian revolts marked the arrival of nationalism amongst a majority Muslim ethnic group. Nationalism had long been deeply rooted within Christian communities. But from now on, Muslim ethnic groups such as Albanians, Kurds, Arabs, and Turks would also begin to articulate their own nationalist visions of the future. This arrival of nationalism amongst Muslims would ultimately spell the end of Ottomanism as a workable project. But for today, we need to turn our attention outwards and catch up with the great powers. Because in the fall of 1911, the Italians would declare war on the Ottomans over control of Libya. This war would begin a period of intense crisis within the empire, as the Ottomans would essentially be engaged in near constant warfare for the next 10 plus years. And this crisis atmosphere would lead the CUP to feel that they were absolutely right, that the only way to protect Ottoman realms from outside aggression was to form a strong government that was authoritarian, centralized, and militarized. All of this will set the stage for the emergence of the CUP dictatorship in 1913. So let's dive into the great power scheming that would culminate with the Italo-Turkish War. On July 1st, 1911, the German battleship SMS Panther dropped anchor at the Bay of Agadir, a strategic port on the Atlantic coast of Morocco. As part of the Entente Cordiale of 1904 between the British and the French, the initial agreement that would fully mature 10 years later into the core alliance of World War I, the British had recognized that France had, quote, special interests in Morocco in exchange for France officially recognizing British control over Egypt. France had then promptly begun to assert their influence in Morocco by dispatching advisors and officers. In response to this increased French presence, the Sultan of Morocco began reaching out to other powers for support in order to lessen French influence. The Germans would be the first to accept this invite for a few reasons. In short, the Anglo-French Entente of 1904 spooked the hell out of the Germans because a core part of German foreign policy, going all the way back to Bismarck, had been the diplomatic isolation of France and the prevention of an alliance bloc that might encircle Germany. The emergence of a British-French alliance would be disastrous for Germany, so the Germans decided to provoke an international crisis in Morocco in hopes of diplomatically isolating the French once more. In March 1905, Kaiser Wilhelm I made a visit to Tangier and met with representatives of the Moroccan Sultan. This was incredibly provocative for the French, who were in the process of increasing their hold in Morocco, and this led to the first Moroccan crisis, which very nearly brought France and Germany into a great power war. In the ensuing negotiations, the Germans found themselves to be quite isolated, with their only great power support coming from Austria-Hungary. So the Germans were humiliated, and the French got their way in Morocco. Then, 5 years later, a rebellion broke out in Morocco, and the French essentially forced the Sultan to ask for their assistance in putting it down. France then began preparing to send troops into Morocco under the classic pretext of European imperialism, protecting the lives and property of French nationals living in Morocco. But, of course, there was absolutely no danger, as the revolt was going down way deep in the interior of Morocco. This French expedition reopened the Moroccan question, and the Germans were not happy at all. In order to strengthen their negotiating position, the Germans sent a battleship, the SMS Panther, to the Bay of Agadir. Now, the Germans did not hope to claim Morocco, but they did want to demand compensation elsewhere in Africa as a result of this French provocation. This was the nature of European imperialism during this era. If you take Morocco, I will need to take, the Congo. Oh, wait, people actually live in these places? Are you sure? And so began the Second Moroccan Crisis, also known as the Agadir Crisis. Just as had happened in the First Moroccan Crisis, the British once again backed the French. This revealed the persistent strength of the British-French Entente. And further, the crisis occurred shortly after the Bosnian crisis that we talked about a few episodes back, and which had revealed Russia's alignment with Britain and France. So, the worst nightmare of German diplomats seemed to be coming true, as the interests of Russia and France were beginning to align, which would leave Germany dangerously encircled by hostile powers. So, following the Second Moroccan Crisis, European leaders gradually began to accept that some sort of great power conflict was, at this point, inevitable. And everyone began to aggressively arm themselves and to prepare for preemptive action. The Second Moroccan Crisis would be the last international crisis before war clouds truly began to form over Europe. But the first great power to disrupt the peace would not be Germany, France, or Britain, but Italy. In late September 1911, during the height of the crisis over in Agadir, Italy invaded Ottoman Libya. The timing of this invasion was highly calculated, as the Italians knew that no other great power would protest their move into Libya, because everyone was too distracted with the events in Morocco. The Italians had had their eyes on Ottoman Libya for decades at this point, going all the way back to the 1878 Congress of Berlin, which redrew the Ottoman Balkans and completely dismantled Ottoman North Africa. Italy had been boxed out of any major territorial gains. This was largely due to the fact that the Italians were the new kids on the block, having only become fully united as the Kingdom of Italy in 1871. As a result of the Congress of Berlin, Great Britain established a colonial presence in Egypt, and France would occupy Tunisia. The city of Tunis was a mere 90 miles off the coast of the Italian island of Sicily. So there was a fairly large population of Italians living in Tunis by the time of the French occupation. Now, this was in large part due to the cosmopolitan nature of the Ottoman Empire and that Tunis was just a pretty diverse place. But the Italians had long thought of Tunis as under their sphere of influence. So the Italians were very angry when the French occupied Tunisia. Within Italy, the French occupation was dramatically dubbed the Slap of Tunis. But even though they were super duper mad, the Italians were not powerful enough militarily or diplomatically to do anything about it. So the Italians bit their lip and began to play a long game in North Africa, as Italian diplomats would carefully lay the groundwork for an eventual Italian occupation of Ottoman Libya. After the French occupation of Tunisia and the British occupation of Egypt, Libya was the last Ottoman holding in North Africa. Now, the Italian lusting over Libya had very little to do with any strategic or commercial interests, and almost everything to do with national prestige. During the war that is to follow, the territory would ironically be dubbed a box of sand, as the region was very sparsely populated, mostly just with nomadic tribes, and was about 90% desert. But the Italians wanted to get in on North Africa, so that they could be seen as equals to Britain and France, who themselves held vast colonial territories in Africa. The political culture in Italy at the turn of the century held that rare combination of imperial ambition coupled with aggressive irredentist nationalism. Because on the one hand, Italy was a great power, but they were a new great power, always the little kid at the cool kid's lunch table who had to like hold Britain's apple juice and give up all their chicken nuggets to France. This parvenu status led Italy to develop an aggressively expansionist agenda that was always wrapped up in imperial mythology, very similar to those in the Balkan states like Bulgaria, Serbia, and Greece. But if in rationalizing their expansionist aims, Greece looked towards ancient Byzantium and Serbia looked towards some random and insignificant kingdom from the Middle Ages, then Italy looked towards ancient Rome. I mean, the Roman Empire had been based in Rome, right? So that must mean that all the people living in lands formerly of the Roman Empire must have some secret Italian essence, right? This was Italian Irredenta, unredeemed Italy, where the people may not actually be Italian in any way we might understand it, but where they would soon learn their essential Italianness, even if they had to be taught it at gunpoint. So, at home, the nationalistic press began to naturalize the idea that Libya, once a part of the Roman Empire, belonged to Greater Italy, even though Roman Libya dated back to BC times, and even though Libya had been a part of the Ottoman Empire for close to 400 years. Running parallel to this propaganda effort at home, Italy also began to establish a presence in the region through building banks, schools, and missions. Finally, the most important work was carried out by Italian diplomats, who would make a series of maneuvers that would ensure no one would stand in the way of an Italian colonial presence in Libya. Starting in the late 1880s, Italy arranged a secret agreement with the British, in which they promised to support British control over Egypt in exchange for Britain's support of Italian Libya. A similar agreement was then made with France in 1902 amidst the first Moroccan crisis. The Italians would support French control over Morocco in exchange for French support of Italian control over Libya. Then, in 1909, in the aftermath of the Young Turk Revolution and the Bosnian crisis, Italy struck a deal with the Russians in which they supported Russia's claim on the Turkish Straits. That left only the Austrians and the Germans. Now, Italy was technically a part of the Triple Alliance with Germany and Austria, but Italy and Austria had long been rivals over control of the Adriatic Sea off the coast of Ottoman Albania. But even though Austria would have typically resisted an aggressive Italian move into Ottoman North Africa, Austria was currently in no position to protest after they had just annexed Bosnia and upset the entire international order. And then, once Germany was distracted with French meddling in Morocco, the time was finally right. So, after decades of diplomatic scheming, the Italians made their move, and the Italian foreign minister, Antonio San Giuliano, pressed the great powers for, quote, compensation in North Africa as a result of the French move into Morocco. None of the great powers resisted the Italian claim for all the reasons we just listed. Now, Germany and Austria did express concern that this was likely to upset the balance of power in a potentially dangerous way, but they were in no position to make any formal demands as a result of the Bosnian crisis and the Moroccan crisis. Meanwhile, the Triple Entente, Russia, Britain, and France, actually encouraged the Italians to make a move into Libya. So, on September the 28th, Foreign Minister San Giuliano sent an ultimatum to the Ottoman government, stating that Italian nationals were being mistreated in Tripoli, and that the Ottomans must accept an Italian occupation of the city. Now, were Italian nationals being mistreated in Tripoli? For sure not, but it did not matter, as this was the realpolitik of European imperialism at work, where might always made right. By the fall of 1911, the Ottoman government in Istanbul was still under the influence of the CUP, though the unionist grip on power had been weakening ever since the 1910 Albanian revolts we talked about last episode. General Mahmoud Shevket's ruthless suppression of the revolts had revealed the new government's brutal authoritarian tendencies. And the draconian policies of the CUP and the militarized government under Mahmoud Shevket were always rationalized under the pretense that centralization and national unity were essential in order to protect the periphery of the empire from the threats of European imperialism and Balkan nationalism. And then a core part of the CUP's identity had long been that of the saviors of the empire, the only party strong enough to protect Ottoman realms from outside attack. What all of this meant in practice was that the CUP government could not accept the Italian ultimatum because it would reveal the CUP as both authoritarian and weak. So, on September the 29th, 1911, the 24-hour Italian ultimatum passed, and Italy and the Ottoman Empire were at war. As we just said, Ottoman Libya had essentially zero strategic value. So, for both the Ottomans and the Italians, control over Libya really came down to its symbolic value. For the Italians, controlling Libya meant an increased colonial presence in Africa, and establishing a colonial presence in Africa was just the thing you did at this time if you were a great power on the rise. For the Ottomans, Libya was their last territory on the continent of Africa, so it had allowed the Ottomans to hold tight to their identity as an empire stretching across three continents. But with that said, there was a reason why France and Britain controlled the rest of North Africa, but had allowed the Ottomans to keep Libya. It was a box of sand. But nevertheless, the war over Libya would be viciously fought, and a lot of the battles would foreshadow not only the horrors of World War I with trench warfare and the introduction of air power, but also 20th century style guerrilla wars fought between an imperial occupier and indigenous insurgents. At the time of the declaration of war, the Ottoman position in Libya was completely untenable. The battalions typically stationed in Libya had been sent over to Yemen to help suppress a local rebellion, so there was not even a full army in Libya at the start of the war. On top of this, the Ottoman navy was too underdeveloped to organize any meaningful transfer of troops from the mainland to the Libyan coast. So, initially, the contingent of 20,000 Italian troops had little trouble in conquering the coastal cities of Tobruk, Derna, Tripoli, and Al-Qum. With these quick and decisive Italian victories, and with the Ottoman army and navy in disarray, the government in Istanbul hesitated. However, patriotic CUP officers began to self-organize a grassroots response to the Italian invasion. In early October, Major Ismail Enver, the revolution's hero of liberty, traveled to Salonika and convened a meeting of the Sacred Committee. And after a long and drawn-out discussion, Enver finally convinced CUP leaders to organize a guerrilla war against the Italian occupation of Libya. Enver detailed his plan in the following way, quote, "We will gather our forces in the Libyan interior, mounted bands of Arabs, citizens of the country, commanded by young Ottoman officers, will stay close to the Italians and harass them night and day. Each Italian soldier or small detachment will be surprised and annihilated. When the enemy is too strong, the bands will withdraw into the open country and continue to harry the enemy at every occasion." Enver planned to bring the Macedonian style of war down to North Africa in order to defend Ottoman honor and prestige. After his session with the CUP Sacred Committee, Enver gathered a group of volunteers. And just as they had done during the 1908 revolution, these volunteers would dub themselves the Fedayi, those who sacrifice. Enver's plan was never officially approved by the government in Istanbul, so he and his fellow Mektebli officers had to find their own way down to Libya, with most Unionist volunteers traveling undercover through British Egypt. One such officer was Mustafa Kemal, the future Ataturk, who disguised himself as a journalist and traveled to Alexandria aboard a Russian warship. Upon their arrival in Libya, Enver was given command of Ottoman forces in Cyrenaica, the eastern portion of Libya, while Mustafa Kemal would lead forces in Tobruk and Derna. Both young officers would continue to make a name for themselves during the Libyan conflict as self-sacrificing Ottoman patriots. But Enver in particular thrived within the harsh environment of the desert guerrilla war. By the time the Fedayi volunteers reached Libya, the major ports had already been easily taken by the Italians. So, Enver, Mustafa Kemal, and other Mektebli officers organized a guerrilla force composed of volunteers from the Ottoman army, together with indigenous Senussi sheikhs and nomadic Bedouin tribesmen. Enver proved highly effective in organizing this insurgency, and he earned great respect amongst the locals. This was in large part due to the fact that the locals revered Enver because of his recent engagement to the niece of Sultan Mehmed V. Enver described this as follows, quote, "Here I am, the son-in-law of the Sultan, the envoy of the Caliph who is giving orders, and it is this tie alone that helps me." But beyond this familial connection to the Sultan Caliph, Enver also threw himself passionately into the conflict, donning Arab robes and fully embracing the harsh nomadic lifestyle of the Bedouin. The local Bedouin fighters and Senussi sheikhs came to respect Enver, Mustafa Kemal, and the other unionists for their selfless commitment to defending the Libyan homeland from foreign encroachment and imperial domination. More than anything else, what brought together the Ottoman volunteers, the Bedouin, and the Senussi was the common bond of Islam. And even though Enver and other Mektebli officers like Mustafa Kemal was secular in the extreme, Enver was struck by this experience fighting alongside the Bedouin, whom he would later describe as, quote, "fanatical Muslims who see death before the enemy as a gift from God." Enver's experience in Libya would stamp him and his fellow Unionist officers with a deep sense of the power of Islam as a potent unifying force that could be harnessed in the future. Further support for this fact was shown in how the war was primarily paid for by donations amongst Muslims. Describing this religious unity, Enver said, quote, "There is no nationality in Islamism." The assumed foil in this statement was Ottomanism, which had so quickly buckled under the weight of nationalist movements amongst the diverse peoples of the empire. Over the next year, the Young Turk officers, together with the local Arab regulars, would prosecute a highly effective guerrilla war against the Italians. And the Italo-Turkish War, as it would come to be called, foreshadowed future conflicts of the 20th century. On November 1st, an Italian plane dropped an aerial bomb on Ottoman forces, and this is often marked as the very first air attack in history. Later on, the Ottomans would also be the first to shoot down an enemy airplane. And then finally, the war also saw the extensive use of telegraphs to communicate with frontline officers. But along with these technological advancements that foreshadowed future mass destruction, the Italo-Turkish War also featured one of the first modern insurgency-style campaigns, in which Ottoman officers and local fighters waged asymmetric warfare against a technologically superior occupier. This pattern would later echo in conflicts like the Vietnam War and the Soviet-Afghan War. The Ottoman forces under CUP Fedayi badgered the Italians and dragged the conflict on much longer than the Italians had anticipated. At the start of the war, the Italians said that the occupation would be more like a, quote, "military walk" than an actual war. But in the end, the conflict would nearly bankrupt the Italian government as they spent almost €1 billion, 500% more than they had originally intended to spend. Laying in stark contrast, with donations offered amongst local Muslims and because of the unofficial nature of Enver's campaign, the Ottoman government actually spent very little on this war. And so, for a brief moment, it seemed as though the Italians might be forced to cut bait and run, and to leave Libya to the Ottomans. However, the nature of this conflict would change completely in the spring of 1912, when Italian warships began to attack Ottoman territory in the eastern Mediterranean. Over the next few months, the Italian Navy would bombard Beirut, occupy Ottoman islands in the Aegean, and finally send torpedo boats into the Turkish Straits. With the Ottoman heartland now under imminent threat, all the dominoes of Ottoman collapse in Europe would begin to fall in rapid succession. And in true late Ottoman fashion, the government would have to face several different crises all at once throughout 1912. The expansion of the Libyan War into the Mediterranean was the first of these crises. The second crisis was the Albanian Revolt of 1912. Beginning in late 1911, opposition to CUP rule had been mounting rapidly. The Italian invasion of Libya exposed major weaknesses in the Ottoman military, and since the CUP's primary identity was that of protectors of the fatherland, the inability of the Unionists to organize any cohesive military response against the Italians would prove fatal to their reputation. And then a turning point would come in November 1911 with the formation of the Freedom and Accord Party. This party was essentially a revamp of Prince Sabahadin's Liberty Party, except now that the CUP was increasingly unpopular, the new Freedom and Accord Party immediately attracted a lot of supporters. And in a by-election, a Freedom and Accord candidate won a surprise victory against a Unionist, signaling that the CUP was rapidly losing its base of support as a result of the war in Libya. Then, in December 1911, Albanian delegates in the Ottoman parliament under the leadership of our old friend Ismail Kemal, who had become a member of the Freedom and Accord Party, opened up a debate to discuss Albanian cultural and political rights. The demands that Ismail Kemal made were, in substance, the same as those made by the rebels who had risen up in 1910. That the CUP allow for the creation of Albanian language schools, that they put an end to military conscription and exploitative taxes, and that they replace the CUP officers who had been appointed as governors with Albanian leaders familiar with local politics. Then, in January 1912, an Albanian member of parliament by the name of Hasan Prishtina warned CUP leaders that if concessions were not made to the Albanians, then a full-blown revolution was likely to break out. Unlike Ismail Kemal, Prishtina had actually at one time been aligned with the CUP when he was first elected to parliament in 1908. However, like many Albanian leaders, Prishtina had been alienated by the centralizing policies of the hardline Turkish Unionists and the authoritarian turn of Mahmud Shevket's government. In response to CUP intransigence, Prishtina switched his allegiance to the Freedom and Accord Party. On the day following Prishtina's warning to Parliament of a possible revolution in Albanian lands, a group of Albanian delegates met at the Para Palace Hotel, with this meeting being organized by Hasan Prishtina and Ismail Kemal. All of the Albanian delegates in attendance agreed to unite their political bases in revolt against CUP rule. Ismail Kemal then promptly began organizing the shipment of tens of thousands of German Mauser rifles into Kosovo, and Prishtina opened up diplomatic negotiations with surrounding Balkan states and with great power representatives. The situation would then begin to deteriorate rapidly, and by spring 1912, widespread revolts had broken out across Kosovo and spread into parts of northern Albania. The rebels demanded administrative autonomy, Albanian language schools, amnesty for political prisoners, and equal representation in the military. Then, in April, while the Albanian revolts were heating up and while the Italians were bombarding the Mediterranean coast, a general election would be held for parliament. After the liberals had won the by-election in late 1911, the CUP began to call for an early election to the General Assembly. The Unionists did this likely in order to break the momentum that the Liberals were clearly gaining. In the end, the 1912 general election would be a complete sham. Leading up to Election Day, both parties campaigned heavily. And one funny aside is that a major issue on the campaign trail was that of religious piety. As we have mentioned, both the Liberals in the Freedom and Accord Party and the Unionists in the CUP were all young Turks who were secularists wishing to modernize the empire and eventually lessen the importance of religion. But seeing as most voters were pious Muslims, the Liberals and the Unionists began accusing each other of being blasphemous. And so these young Turks were all of the sudden using Islamist rhetoric on the campaign trail and claiming to be more pious than the other party. But even with these wildly cynical campaign tactics, the CUP would win a huge majority in parliament, securing 269 seats out of 275, which, you know, guys, seems a bit suspicious. Maybe if you're trying to rig an election, you could, make it a little less obvious. After this landslide victory, reports began to circulate of widespread CUP fraud and intimidation during the election, including one report given by a liberal running in Edirne, who claimed he was beaten by a mob of Unionists while on the campaign trail. Such incidents led this election to be dubbed the Election of Clubs. The strongman tactics of the Unionists were just way too obvious, and the election fraud sparked widespread outrage and made the CUP even more unpopular. As a direct result of the Election of Clubs, the Albanian revolts intensified because many Albanians like Ismail Kemal and Hasan Prishtina had come to align themselves with the Freedom and Accord Party, who had just been cheated out of power. In the months following the sham election, a dangerous constellation of forces would coalesce in opposition to the CUP, and all began to agree that radical action was needed in order to prevent a CUP dictatorship that would likely see the empire through to its final demise. Interestingly, this anti-CUP coalition would be led by a former Unionist and Mektebli officer named Mehmed Sadik. Leading up to the revolution, Sadik had been a loyal CUP agent, so much so that he became the head of the all-important branch in Monastir, where the revolution had first begun. So, Sadik was right in the middle of the action during the revolutionary events of 1908, as he helped organize the assassination of General Shimshi Pasha, which had been the major turning point for the CUP, and he sent a barrage of telegrams to Istanbul demanding the reinstatement of the constitution. However, after the Young Turk Revolution, Sadik had a major falling out with important members of the Sacred Committee in Salonika, specifically Talat and the Dönme Minister of Finance, Javid. Sadik was prone to conspiracy theories, so his beef with hardcore Unionists tended to center around his accusations that the CUP was being secretly driven by Freemasons and Jewish Zionists, which, as we've said before, is not at all true, even if Talat was a Freemason and Javid was a Dönme. But nonetheless, Sadik garnered a loyal following, especially amongst middle-ranking officers who began to chafe under the dominance of young, educated Mektebli officers of the CUP. And then, after breaking away completely from the CUP, Sadik would be one of the original founders of the Freedom and Accord Party in 1911, and he would give the party an important military connection. Then, after the fraud and intimidation during the Election of Clubs, Sadik organized a group of his followers in the military and began planning a coup to overthrow the CUP government. This group, led by Sadik, would dub themselves the Savior Officers. The Savior officers had established important connections amongst military officers and rank-and-file soldiers in Albania and Macedonia. So, when army units were dispatched to put down the Albanian revolts in June 1912, these units quickly began to defect to the Albanian cause, in a move that echoed the 1908 Young Turk mutinies. These mutinous soldiers, associated with the Savior officers, sent a demand to Istanbul that a new government had to be formed. Seeing the way the winds were blowing, General Mahmud Shevket would resign in a show of support for the Savior officers. Shevket's resignation then led to a cascade of other resignations of CUP-aligned ministers. The CUP-aligned Grand Vizier, Said Pasha, for a moment held strong and refused to resign. But then, in late June, the Savior officers out in Albania published a manifesto and threatened to march on the capital, in a move that once again directly mirrored Unionist tactics in 1908 and 1909. In response to this threat of an occupation of Istanbul, the Grand Vizier Said Pasha finally resigned. In late July, Sultan Mehmed V announced that a new government of national unity would be formed under the legendary and absolutely geriatric Ottoman commander, Gazi Ahmed Muhtar Pasha. Now, everyone hoped that this war hero, whose services went all the way back to the Crimean War, would be able to prevent further political polarization that seemed at this point possible to risk civil war. This new government would come to be known as the Great Cabinet. In early August, under increasing pressure from the Savior officers, Ahmed Muhtar dissolved the CUP-dominated parliament. And with that, the coup was complete, and the Unionists had lost their executive power in government and had lost their majority in parliament. So, it seemed that the Ottoman Empire might now be led by a nonpartisan government of national unity, under the thumb of the Savior officers and the liberals in the Freedom and Accord Party. However, the 1912 coup of the Savior officers did not stop the epic crisis that was gripping the empire. And just months after taking control, the new government under Ahmed Muhtar would face the greatest threat yet to Ottoman survival. In October 1912, in response to fears of an independent Albania and in an effort to take advantage of Ottoman weakness amidst the war with Italy, a coalition of Balkan states, Bulgaria, Greece, Serbia, and Montenegro, formed an alliance and declared war on their former Ottoman overlord. The Balkan Wars had begun, and the fight for Ottoman Europe was on.